I'll never forget the phone call from Augusta, Georgia, to my home in Columbia, South Carolina. So on December the 26th, the telephone wires must literally have been burning up with excitement. As he called me, he said, you know, since our conversation, I have kept exact records. He said, I know exactly how much business I get every time I knock on a door. I know how much business I get every time I make a phone call. How much business I get every time I open my briefcase, every time I put on a demonstration. He said, I know how much business I sell every week, every day. He said, I can even tell you how much business I sell every single hour that I work. And he said, I'm going to break that record. I said, oh, no, you're not going to break the record. I said, you just broke it. Now, my listening friends, let me tell you why I said that. See, he didn't use the word if anywhere in the conversation. And if you look at the word life itself, L-I-F-E, if you'll take the two center letters out of life, it's if. Half of life itself is if, and he didn't fall back on a single one. He didn't say, I'll break the record if I don't wreck my car, and it's good that he didn't, because he did. He didn't say, I'll break that record if there's no illness in my family, and there was. He didn't say, I'll break the record if there are no deaths in my family, and he buried two loved ones, including a brother. He didn't say, I'll break the record if I don't lose my voice. And ladies and gentlemen, in the month of December, with the goal so close he could absolutely smell it and feel it and touch it, with it so close it was his, he completely lost his voice. And for 22 agonizing days, he could not even whisper. He simply said, I'll break the record, period. Ladies and gentlemen, let me emphasize something. The most he had ever sold in a single year was $34,000, and that was not a bad job itself back in those years. But the next year, selling the same product in the same area to the same people at the same price under the same economic conditions, he delivered and paid for over $104,000 worth of cookware, over three times as much. I tell the story because, ladies and gentlemen, when we break the goal into segments, we realize that all the characteristics of goal setting and goal reaching are involved. Number one, it was his goal. Nobody else set it for him. He wanted to do that. Number two, he found out where he was. He kept records. He knew exactly how much business he got when he made a sales call. You see, so many times I'll ask members of a sales organization, how much you get every time you, how much business you sell every time you make a sales call? And they give me company averages, not what they're doing. It's your average that gets to be important. And what he was talking about was his exact average. He found out exactly where he was. And the third thing about that particular goal, it was very, very specific. Fourth, it was big. But it was not an impossible, nor was it an irresponsible goal. He had measured based on past performance as to what he was capable of doing. It was a long-range goal. It was for 1 year. Then he broke it into segments on a daily basis, and then he was prepared mentally to discipline himself, and finally, he was confident that he was going to reach that particular goal. When I started writing this book, ladies and gentlemen, I put some pretty strong words in it. When I started preparing for this course, I put some strong words in it. But I started the book 2 years ago. And as I wrote the words, I put down, you can go where you want to go, you can do what you want to do, you can be like you want to be. And as I read those words, you know, I got to confess, I looked at them and I said, Zig, that's pretty good. As a matter of fact, I got involved with talking to myself. And there's nothing wrong with talking to yourself. And, you know, nothing wrong even with answering. But if you ever catch yourself saying, huh? Well, I caught myself saying, huh, to the answer, and I knew then I was in trouble because, you see, in the book, when I said, you can be like you want to be, and I looked at the word and I said, hey, that's pretty good. And I had to hold those words a long way off because I had a 41-inch waistline, and I weighed 202 pounds. And then the thought occurred to me that one of these days I was going to be running into somebody who had read the book, and they was going to say, Zig, do you believe everything you wrote in that book? And I was going to say, yeah. And they said, what about the part that says you can be like you want to be? Are you like you want to be? And then I was going to say, well, you know, as authors, we kind of have to take a little literary license every once in a while. And Yeah, I mean, you understand. In other words, Ziegler, I understand you're a liar. Man, look, don't call me a liar. That's pretty hard words. Well, at least you're a hypocrite. Then I said, don't call me a hypocrite. As I was writing these words, you know, and looking at that 41-inch waistline, I said, Ziegler, you're going to have to take the words out of the book, or you're going to have to do something about you. And then my son at the time was 8 years old, and I have a belief. I think every father ought to be able to whip his children until they're 12. And the rate I was going, I wasn't even going to be able to catch mine, much less whip him. But the straw that broke the camel's back, my redhead kept telling me to hold my stomach in, and I already was. So I knew I had to do something. I went down to Cooper's Clinic right out here on Preston Road. He wrote the book Aerobics, and when you see people out jogging, you can rest assured Kenneth Cooper had something to do with it. Went down for the examination, 5 hours. First thing they did was took 2 quarts of my blood. At least it looked like 2 quarts. They just kept filling those little vials. I thought they were starting a blood bank right then and there. And then they dunked me in a tank of water 3 times, and the purpose was to find the percentage of body fat that I had. Well, they told me I was 23 9/10% pure lard. And then they put me on a treadmill, and on the treadmill, you know, you walk and you walk and you walk and you walk and you walk, and the length of your walk, the number of minutes, determines your physical condition. Well, I was somewhat chagrined to discover that I could only get 4 seconds out of horrible condition. But when it was all over, the young examining physician, Dr. Martin, called me in, and big smile on his face, skinny, of course he was, runs the Boston Marathon, all those good things. And he said, well, Mr. Ziegler, he said, you're going to be very pleased to know that our calculations, and we use a computer so we know they're accurate, and we have discovered that you are not overweight. However, he said, according to our figures, you are exactly 5 1/2 inches too short. And I said, well, Doc, that's pretty bad. And he said, no, he said, actually, you're in remarkably good physical condition for a 66-year-old. And I said, Doc, I'm 46. He said, you're in awful shape. He said, as a matter of fact, if you were a building, I'd condemn you. And I said, well, Doc, what can I do? And he whipped out a stack of papers as thick as my book, and he started telling me what I could do. By the time he got through, I was kind of like the little boy that asked his daddy a question. His daddy said, well, why don't you ask your mother? And he said, well, I didn't want to know that much about it. Well, I didn't really want to know that much about it either, but when he finally told me that much about it and I got home, my redhead said, well, I suppose you're going to be out running all over the place now. And I said, yes. Well, she said, if I'm going to have a 46-year-old fat boy running all over the place, I'm going to get you looking just as good as I can. So she went down to the store and bought me some fancy running shirts and shorts and all this stuff. And I'd already asked the doctor the kind of shoes to get, and he had told me, and I had them. And, oh, there's one other thing. When I was in the doctor's office, I did something that's kind of ugly, but I hadn't read Ann Landers that day, and I'll use that as my excuse, although I really knew better. You know, Ann says you should not steal pages out of other folks' magazines, and I had stolen a page out of the doctor's magazine. It was an advertisement for jockey shorts. Now, I don't know if you folks read those jockey short ads or not. If you don't read them, the next time you see one, you ought to at least look at the picture, because you're going to find out they don't put jockey shorts on fat boys. At least they don't have a good year. So I had that picture of the fellow in the jockey shorts. I hung it up in the bathroom, and I said, now that's it. That's the way I'm going to look. One of these days, there's my hero. And boy, the next morning, that alarm clock sounded off, and I hopped out of bed, slipped on that fancy running outfit, hit that front door, and ran a block. But the next day I did a whole lot better. I ran a block and a mailbox. And the next day it was a block and 2 mailboxes, then a block and 3 mailboxes. One day I ran all the way around the block. I came back in, woke the whole family up, and I said, guess what Dad has done? And then one day I ran a 0.5 mile. Then one day I ran a mile, then 1.5 miles, then 2 miles. One day I started doing sit-ups. First day only 8, then 10, then 20, then 40, then 80, then 120. Then I started doing push-ups. Only 6 the first day, then 8, then 10, then 20, then 30, then 40. And today I do the GI push-up. That means you push up and slap your hands while you're in the air. And the weight started coming down from 202 to 200, 190, 180, 170, and 165. And the waistline dropped all the way from 41 to 34. And ladies and gentlemen, 10 months before the book went to the publisher, I had already written in the book 10 months in advance that I weighed 165 pounds and had a 34-inch waistline. To the ounce and to the day and to the inch, I was on target. Now, why do I give you all these details? I give you all the details again because regardless of what you're doing in life, you can take the identical principles and apply them to your own life. Whatever your objective is, you identify the principles, lay it out in exactly the same way, and this is the way that you will be able to set and be able to reach your objectives. I will say two or three things about dieting. Number one, if you're interested in losing weight, make certain that you're interested and nobody else has talked you into losing weight. There are two major reasons why you should not get on a roller coaster diet. First reason is psychological. If you lose 20 pounds and then gain back 30, then you are worse off than if you had never lost any weight at all because you've tried something and failed, and now you've got another failure that you've got to overcome. Psychologically, it's rough, but physiologically, it is also rough. And the reason is when you lose weight, you don't lose cells. When you lose weight, the cells simply shrink. But when you gain weight, you gain cells. And therefore, every time you then get on a diet, it gets more and more difficult. This is not something that you play with. You want to lose weight, you get on a CS diet. Now, that stands for common sense. Get on a good CS diet after you have had a thorough physical examination and you've completely determined that that's what you want to do. The first step, of course, is get the examination from a skinny doctor. If he is not skinny, he cannot give you everything you need, including the psychological reinforcement at the time you're going to need it. He does not totally believe what he's telling you to do if he's overweight. Get you a skinny doctor. Number two, if he starts to give you a prescription for pills, don't walk out on him, run out on him. You didn't get, overweight taking pills. You're not going to get underweight taking pills. That's just a fact. And if you think about it that long, if pills worked, there'd be no such thing as a fat doctor. Now, you think about it just for a moment. And finally, on your diet, and then I'm through with the dieting part of it, on your diet, if the doctor tells you what you can't eat, swap doctors. See, you are too ornery and obstinate and stubborn. If you're like 99 9/10% of all the Americans I've ever met, you are that way, and you don't want people always telling you what you can't have. You ask me today, what can't I eat? And I don't have any earthly idea what I can't eat. Why should I clutter my mind with a bunch of stuff I can't even have anyhow? Now, you ask me what I can eat, then I'll tell you exactly what I can eat. It's very easy. I can eat roast, and I can eat steak, and I can eat chicken, and I can eat fish, and I can eat vegetables, and I can eat salad, but I don't want all of this negativism going into my mind about what I can't have. We live in too negative a world as it is. Why, even the weatherman comes on and says, we got a 40% chance of rain. Why don't the dirty dog tell me I got a 60% chance of sunshine? That's what I want to hear. So that's enough about the diet, but let me tell you what was involved. In goal setting, first of all, it was my goal, and my credibility was at stake. The second thing was the fact that it was a very specific goal. 37 pounds is about as specific as you can get. Third thing, it was a big goal. That is a lot of weight. And the fourth thing about it was I had broken it down into objectives. You see, I knew 10 months later I was going to the publisher. I looked at 37, I divided it by 10, that came out 3.7, and I knew that I could lose 3.7 pounds a month. That's not an insurmountable obstacle. And you see, that's very important that you do that. You got to have the right mental attitude, knowing that you can accomplish your objective, or else you're going to have extreme difficulty in getting there. And finally, I put it on a daily basis. I divided the 3.7 by 30, and I found out that all I had to do was lose 1 9/10 ounces a day, and I would lose in 10 months 37 pounds. Dr. McClellan, at Harvard again found that when you want to reach your objectives, you must have what he calls accomplishment feedback. And every day I'd step on the scales and see a little less of me, then my confidence would grow for the next objective and grow for the next one and grow for the next one. Yes, we involved all of the principles in goal setting and goal reaching on this one. And as you listen back to this over and over, apply the principles, and as you read them in the book, they're spelled out in minute detail as to exactly what you need to do as far as setting and reaching your goals are concerned. But ladies and gentlemen, you remember a few moments ago the cookware salesman I was talking about? The reason he was able to reach his objective was the fact that he had done something that's so critically important. In the process of reaching his objective, he had learned how to train fleas. Now, as a matter of curiosity, how many of you in this live audience do not know how to train fleas? Could I see your hands, please? Well, Glenn, it looks like I got here just in time. Because I'll tell you, if you don't know how to train fleas, you haven't got a chance in the game of life. And I know you heard the one about the two fleas at the bottom of the hill, and one of them says, well, do we walk or take a dog? Hey, this might not be the right time to ask, but how many of you would like to see me on the Johnny Carson Show on September 19? Is it? Well, I see every hand that went up, so I assume that you're serious. If you'll write him and that includes everybody that listens to this recording, and tell him that you would like to see me on his show, and I'm also available the 18th and the 20th. Then, you know, we create a public furor, and enough people write, I will be invited. So you said you wanted to see me there. I assume you're serious. Write him the letter, and who knows what might happen. Okay, you train fleas by putting them in a jar, and fleas jump. They'll jump up and hit the top. And as they jump up and hit the top over and 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 over, you keep watching them, then all of a sudden you'll notice something. You'll notice that even though they continue to jump, all of a sudden they're no longer hitting the top. And that's a fact. And then you can take the top completely off, and they'll keep on jumping, 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 but they cannot jump out because they've conditioned themselves to jump just so high. And once they've conditioned themselves to jump just so high, that's all there is. There ain't no more. And mankind is exactly the same way. They start out in life to climb the mountain, to write the book, to break the record. They start in life to do a lot of things, but along the way, they bump their heads, they stub their toes, and they become what I call a snop. That's spelled S-N-I-O-P. And that's a person who is susceptible to the negative influence of other people. They start listening to the negative Nels and the negative Charlies of life who say, you can't, you can't, you can't. The 4-minute mile is a perfect example. For years and years, athletes tried to run a mile in less than 4 minutes, and they couldn't until 1954. In 54, Roger Bannister of Great Britain ran a mile in less than 4 minutes, and then athletes the world over started running miles in less than 4 minutes. Roger Bannister was a flea trainer. Why couldn't other people do it before Roger Bannister could? Very simple. The coach had taken his stopwatch and put it on the athlete and said, you can't do it, you can't do it, you can't do it. The doctor had taken his stethoscope and said, your heart will come out of your body. You can't do it, you can't do it, you can't do it. And the athlete was snipped right out of the 4-minute mile. Then a flea trainer broke the barrier. And when Bannister broke the barrier, since that date, over 500 races have been run in less than 4 minutes, including one by a 37-year-old man. And right over here in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, June of 1973, 8 guys, same race, ran a race in less than 4 minutes. In case you've missed the point, a flea trainer is a person who is driven from within. A flea trainer is a person who jumps out of the jar. A flea trainer is a person who understands that you can get everything in life that you want if you will just help enough other people get what they want. A flea trainer doesn't try to see through people. A flea trainer sees people through. A flea trainer doesn't tell others where to get off. A flea trainer shows them how to get on. A flea trainer, you see, is convinced that inside of that individual there is that enormous amount of ability to go where they want to go, to do what they want to do, to be what they want to do, and to have what they want to have. And you see, once you understand this principle, some amazing changes take place. For example, the young cookware salesman I mentioned earlier, I know, was not all of a sudden possessed with a degree of genius, because I'm talking about a younger brother. I know him real good. And I know that all of a sudden, he did not possess an extra amount of intelligence, but simply he possessed that goal and attitude concept that made such an enormous ability. You want to reach your goals once you've gotten them set? Then you got to understand the story of Houdini. Houdini, as some of you know, was a master magician. He also was a master locksmith. It was his boast that he could get out of any jail cell in the world if you would just let him walk in that jail with his street clothes on. And so there was a small jail in a small town in the British Isles, built a new jail. They were terribly proud of it. They issued Houdini a challenge. Come try to get out of our jail. And Houdini responded to the challenge. There was a lot of publicity, a lot of money, and he liked them both. So he was driving or riding into town. The drums were beating. The bugles were blaring. The publicity drums had been going full blast. There was an enormous crowd. He strode very confidently into that jail. They closed the door behind him, and Houdini took his coat off. Secreted in his belt, there was a 10-inch piece of steel, very tough, very flexible, very durable, and he went to work on the door. Then of 30 minutes, that confident expression had disappeared. At the end of an hour, he was drenched in perspiration. At the end of 2 hours, he literally collapsed against the door, which opened. And it is a true story. It opened, ladies and gentlemen, because it had never been locked anywhere except in his own mind, which means that it was locked just as completely, just as successfully as if every locksmith in the world had put their best lock on it. Now, tell the story, because you see, the truth of the matter is there are people wanting to open the door for you. They don't want to close it, they want to open it. Can you believe that your boss would love to give you a raise? Can you believe that your employer would like to pay you more money and give you a promotion? But if I understand anything at all about free enterprise, which I'll be talking about in a later recording, your boss or your employer is not running a benevolent institution. And he wants to pay you more money, but he wants to pay you only if you become worth more to him. And this is going to shock you, but $5,000 and $10,000 a year people are relatively easy to find. It's the $25,000 and $50,000 a year people who are very difficult to find. But in order to earn this kind of money, you got to make that kind of a contribution. I believe inside of every human being there's an enormous capacity. I believe man was designed for accomplishment. I believe he was engineered for success. I believe that he was endowed with the seeds of greatness. But if you're going to reach your goal, you got to understand the story of the young sailor at sea. He was ordered aloft for the first time. It was in the days of the sailing boat. And there was a squall coming up. And he'd been ordered to trim the sails. And when he climbed up, he made a mistake of looking down. And he could see the roll of the ship and the turbulence of the sea. And he became nauseated. He lost his balance. He started to fall. And an older sailor underneath him said, "Look up, son. Look up." And the young man immediately looked up and regained his balance. And the story simply says to us, when things don't look good, and that is going to happen in your life, when things don't look good, look to make certain you're not looking in the wrong direction. You see, when you're looking at the sun, you see no shadows. If the outlook isn't good, try the uplook, because it's always good. Want to reach your goal? You got to make up your mind you're going to reach it. A number of years ago, an international expedition was formed to climb the north wall of the Matterhorn. A reporter was interviewing the people who were involved. They went to one young man and said, "Are you going to climb the north wall of the Matterhorn?" He said, "I'm going to give it a jolly good effort." Went to another man and said, "Are you going to climb?" And he said, "I'm going to give it everything I got." Went to another man and said, "Are you going to climb it?" He said, "I'll be caught trying." And he went to a young American and said, "Are you going to climb the north wall of the Matterhorn, something that has never been done before?" And the young American said, "I will climb the north wall of the Matterhorn." One man did. It was the man who said, "I will." Want to reach your goal? You've got to literally see the reaching. I quit seeing myself as the 202-pound friendly fat boy. I started seeing myself as the friendly 165-pounder. Major Nesmith's story says what I want to say. He was a golfer. He was a lousy one. Shot in the 90s. As a matter of fact, he quit playing golf then for over 7 years. Didn't pick up a golf stick. Then he went back to the golf course after a 7-year sabbatical, and first time back, he shot a 74. For 7 years, he was a prisoner of war. He was in the Hanoi Hilton, a prisoner of the North Vietnamese. And for 7 years, all they did was put his body in jail. They did not confine his mind. And for 7 years, he played mental golf, 18 full holes of it. He stroked the ball thousands and thousands of times. He never missed a shot. And then when he got back to the golf course, he physically did what he had mentally been doing all of these years. Yeah, you got to see the reaching. He saw the ball dropping in the cup. He saw the ball splitting the fairway. He saw success and success and success. Want to reach your goals? You got to remember, finally, the story of the Apostle Peter. I bet you remember old Peter. He was the enthusiastic one. He was the extrovert. Boy, with old Peter, nothing was just good. It was fantastic. Nothing was just bad. It was awful. No mediocre words for old Peter anywhere. And it's the story of him walking on water. You know, the sea's not too smooth, and the Lord's walking on it. And old Peter said, "Lord, I would walk on water." And Christ simply said, "Come." No, Peter stepped out of the boat. You remember, I can just see him in my own mind's eye. I can see him stepping out there and walking. And then the scripture says, but when he saw the winds boisterous, he was afraid. Did you ever wonder why he saw the winds boisterous? He saw them only for one reason, and that was because he took his eyes off the goal, Jesus Christ. I don't care what your goal is. When you take your eye off the goal, you see the problem. So I'm simply going to say this. If you want to reach your goal, you got to keep your eye on the goal. You got to look at the solution and not the problem. And remember, you don't pay the price. You enjoy the price when you set and reach your goals, which you can if you'll follow through. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Please advance the tape and then turn the cassette over to repeat the listening process.